I do believe that racism is an issue in society. I think that we've got past issues of racism, at least in America. I don't know so much about the UK, but certainly in the United States, past issues of racism impact what happens today. And so you have to find a way to deal with that. And then also there are present issues that are more subtle. And so they're not like the hardcore discrimination and segregation of the past. And so even though they're subtle, they still have an impact on people's lives. So in my case, I grew up in the 80s, early 90s. I lived on one side of the city, which was the Black side. I had little access to things that we would call, sociologists would call, cultural capital or social capital. In other words, I didn't know anyone who had money. I didn't know anyone who was in a white collar job. I didn't know anyone who could get me in a job. I didn't know anything about college, nothing. And it wasn't because my parents and people in my neighborhood didn't want me to do well, but I'm the first generation of Black people who had full civil rights.
Okay, I'm joined today by Rod Graham. Rod is an associate professor of sociology at Old Dominion University in the US and is the host of the Conversations and Perspectives podcast. He's got a really interesting perspective on politics in general. So, Rod, thanks for joining me on the Easy Review podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So what's your podcast generally about? What do you focus on that?
So I try to do them in just series. So right now I'm doing a culture war series. And although I have a particular political viewpoint, I actually want to get different people's perspectives on things. Yeah. And I don't get to, I don't care who it is. As long as they got something interesting to say, I'll just talk to them. So right now I'm doing culture wars. In the past, though, I stuck to things that I studied and researched. So I did a cybercrime series. I did a series on sex work and sex trafficking. And I did one on racial inequality.
Okay. So, yeah, even from what you said there, it stands out that you're slightly different to quite a lot of the commentators around at the moment, in that you're kind of actively happy to and seeking to chat to people from all different perspectives. I know a lot of people say that they are, but in reality, I don't think it actually works out like that very often. So what would you say your perspective is? You know, you said before your own perspective, what would you say your kind of your general outlook is?
Well, so I am definitely liberal. Actually, since now liberal is... people, you know, there's a kind of disagreement about what that means. So I'll say I'm progressive economically and probably conservative socially. So that's sort of that puts me in an odd space. But because I see my conservative views as more personal, like maybe my stance on abortion or something, I see that as something that it's just my own values. So when I vote based on the economics. So that usually means I'm voting progressive for Democrats in the US.
Okay. I genuinely did not expect that you were going to say that you have conservative social views. I actually thought you were going to say you're already progressive. So what are the social views you hold?
People are surprised about that. But some of it's based just on my background. So I'm culturally Christian. I grew up in the American South, and most Black people in American South are very religious. So although I don't have faith per se, I think that all societies need some values. And so I think, you know, Christian values are fine, you know. So in that way, I'm socially conservative. It's also the case that the research that I've done or teach about shows that there's certain things that in society that actually benefit society. So strong families do help. So even though we're in a very liberal age, and people are free to have any kind of family arrangement they want. If they want to be a single parent, that's fine. I'm not against that. But of course, the data suggests that two parents matter. So in that way, I'm socially. And also when it comes to immigration, it's one thing to have a controlled immigration, which allows groups to come in and maybe assimilate. But it's another to not recognize that people have cultures and histories in the area, and you wreck that by just allowing people to come in and not think about the consequences. So, yeah.
Okay, that's pretty interesting. So How does that manifest itself when you look at the political scene at the moment in the US? Do you see that one side kind of represents your position well, or do you feel that there's you're kind of politically homeless?
Well, no, I will vote Democrat because those views that I have, they're kind of personal. Like it would be nice if people would really focus on a two-parent home, but that's not my obligation to make them do that. Like that's how they want to be. However, I think that things like universal healthcare, more money put into education, these types of economic issues are so important that they're not just personal. And so if I can vote for a party that will deal with that, and also racial inequality, which I'm also interested in. So if I can vote for a party that will deal with that, I will. And that's the Democrats.
So what's your view on the racial inequality situation in the US? Actually, kind of even before that, you're like a Black American from the South. So which means you definitely have much more experience of what that's like, you know, just what it's like to grow up Black in the South in America. So what was your kind of experience of that growing up, and how do you view that situation?
Well, so just in general, I do believe that racism is an issue in society. I think that we've got past issues of racism, at least in America. I don't know so much about the UK, but certainly in the United States, past issues of racism impact what happens today. And so you have to find a way to deal with that. And then also there are present issues that are more subtle. And so they're not like the hardcore discrimination and segregation of the past. And so even though they're subtle, they still have an impact on people's lives. So in my case, I grew up in the 80s, early 90s. And I lived on one side of the city, which was the Black side. I had little access to things that we would call, sociologists would call, cultural capital or social capital. In other words, I didn't know anyone who had money. I didn't know anyone who was in a white collar job. I didn't know anyone who could get me in a job. I didn't know anything about college, nothing. And it wasn't because my parents and people in my neighborhood didn't want me to do well, but I'm the first generation of Black people who had full civil rights. So my mother, you know, she finished high school in a segregated school and she went to work. What did she do? I think she went into the cotton fields for a while and then she went into industry, working in a factory. But she has no idea of what, you know, anything about a white collar type world, and she had no money. So that impacted my life early on, right? And that still goes on today, just not as strong. It's more subtle, but still impactful. Nowadays, some of the things are like the police brutality issues. I think that's something to worry about. Because of segregation, it is often the case that Black folks tend to go to inferior schools. So whether or not they're smart or not smart, lazy or hardworking, it doesn't matter. They're in an environment that doesn't foster doing well. So those are things that you have to deal with today.
Okay. And so what do you make of the kind of critical theory based explanations for the situation facing Black Americans, and also just in general critical theory? Because that's something which I've seen you get into a lot of debates about on social media.
I do tend to get into it, but it's weird because, so as someone who is a data oriented researcher, I don't do critical theory.
Yeah.
But as it happens, I guess I'll be critical theory adjacent because I understand the point of it. So I'm not like opposed to it. But as it happens, I taught a course on research methods, and I still do, where I have to teach students this particular way of doing research, which is critical social science. So I'm coming at it from that standpoint, where I kind of know, okay, there are three ways of understanding the world. Through a social science viewpoint. So one is collecting hard data. One is interviewing people, what we would call qualitative data. And then this third way is a value-oriented dealing with social issues problem way, which is critical social science. And so that's kind of how I'm going into it. So from that standpoint, I think that it's important that we have that in social science. But it's also the case that it can be very sexy. The words can, there are a lot of buzzwords going on. And so people make it more than it needs to be. It should be a niche area, but it shouldn't be the main way of producing knowledge, I think.
Yeah, so that's, you mentioned that kind of you think there's validity to it, but also that some people put far too much emphasis on it as a kind of catch-all explanation for much more complex issues. Is that a good summary of how you do it?
Maybe. So, for example, this idea of whiteness, this idea that in Western societies, white folks are the center. And so we judge everything based on whiteness, the looks, the attitudes, the behaviors. And so that has an impact on non-whites in some way, and also on whites. So it can be difficult for white folks to imagine that other people have completely different lives. Okay, that's a good theoretical starting point. It's fine. Yeah. That's a good way to talk about something in class. And I like the concept, and that's coming directly from critical theory. Okay, but that's not enough. You also need to go do some hardcore research to see, well, what are the actual impacts of that, if any? And so that gets lost. I'm not like the Lindsay Pluckrose crowd who think, oh, this is all terrible, you know, throw it out, you know.
Yeah.
Nor am I like, I don't know, who would be a critical, Robin DiAngelo type who thinks like, this is great, you know, this is the way to understand the world. I'm kind of in the middle.
Yeah. So basically, so you're, because I've had James Lindsay on this show before. And so basically what seems to happen from my perspective is that the conversation, even around this quite niche area, gets really quickly polarized to the extent that either you kind of accede to just completely disregard all critical theory as absolutely useless, or you more or less buy into most of its weird kind of assertions and just accept them uncritically and get really offended when anyone holds them up to any scrutiny. Whereas from my perspective, it seems like there's probably a degree of validity to some of the points made, but also there are serious flaws with some of the ways it goes about explaining things and tries to understand the world. And so it's useful to kind of take the insights it can give you and not throw the baby out with the bathwater, but also not to take it as a kind of dogmatic thing which can't be questioned. What's your view on that?
That is actually a problem with the people who are really into critical theory. If you say, well, you know, is there evidence for this, or if there's another way of dealing with this issue, then the response is sometimes very negative. They may see it as an attack on them. And I think that's because if you're a scientist, you're comfortable with what we call an alternative hypothesis. That's kind of how it works. But with critical theory, the idea is that this is value-oriented. We're dealing with oppression and inequality. If you come up with an alternative view, then what you're telling me is that you are for oppression or inequality. Yeah. That's kind of the way of thinking about it. I think that's a little, it's a bit dogmatic, as I think you said. So no, that's not the best way. I should say, though, I do follow the Twitter conversations on this. I have not read Cynical Theories yet. I don't know if I will, but I know it's very popular for certain people.
That's James Lindsay's book, James Lindsay and Helen Pluckrose.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. But immediately I'm thinking, how is it possible that they can come to such strong conclusions without being in academia or practicing critical theory or even talking with people in critical theory? So I haven't read it yet, so I can't go any further than that.
Yeah.
But in my case, because I'm in academia, my department has a critical theory component, but it's like one of every four or five scholars, and they do critical criminology and fine, right? But all the grant funding goes to standard research. I mean, it just doesn't seem like it's that much of an issue for me to cause so much trouble.
Something else which you've talked about, which is related to what we were just discussing, is your view of the discussion around free speech. So that's partly why I wanted to get you on the show, because I often end up getting into these debates or kind of reading the debate about free speech and the discussion in the kind of culture wars side of things about the situation for free speech in the US and the UK. And I think it becomes really polarized to the extent that people say either that free speech is massively under threat and cancel culture has gone mad and it's like we need absolute free speech and that's it. And other people say it's fine, basically nothing's happened and free speech itself is really problematic, and so anyone who's defending it is just racist. And I think that I can't completely come down on one side of that really fundamentally. I think that I can understand both points of view. What's your view on the situation though?
Well, so there are two things going on, I think. One is just the actual human behavior of censoring speech, or just enforcing norms, I guess. And so, you know, imagine if it's 1845 or so, and you're in the American South, and you're a white guy who does not own any slaves, and you say to your slave owning buddy, you know, this slavery stuff is stupid. Ah, let's get rid of it. You know, this kind of thing. Okay, well, the slave owners are going to censor that guy, right? Get out of town. We don't want you here because you're saying things that are damaging to me. I mean, let's go 1950 and someone says, you know, that Stalin guy, I think he was still alive in 1950. That Stalin guy, he's actually not that bad. Look, I mean, you know, all of a sudden the Soviet Union has a lot of industry now. So, you know, well, that guy is, you know, he can't have a job anywhere in the United States. So there was, and probably the UK as well. So there's always been some words and ideas that were taboo in society. There's no way around it. I think the difference is we have technology now, which makes it possible, or we have a new technology now, which makes it possible for people who are not in the immediate scene to help enforce the norm. So I say something on this channel that someone doesn't like. So for example, I mentioned that I'm sort of pro-life, not sort of pro-life, I am pro-life. Yeah. Okay, who knows? Somebody might take that clip and then put it online, and then a million people who don't know me will say, oh, this guy can't be a professor anywhere because look at this idea. So, I mean, I think there is a cancel culture, but it's not new and it's not going away. It just shifts. So right now we're talking about these words. 20 years from now, we'll be talking about another set of words.
But do you think that, so what's, I mean, I wasn't alive in the 50s or in the 1860s.
Me either. I'm not that old. I wasn't alive in the 50s.
Yeah, so I don't know what the normative system would have been like and what it would have felt like to live under that system. But I, you know, you can make an educated guess by reading about who the dominant people were, the dominant figures, the dominant intellectuals, and, you know, the culture at that time. And it seems to me, and quite a lot of people, that at the moment, it's the progressive side of things which is the more censorious and illiberal, and is the primary, it's giving the biggest push to limit the parameters of free speech and discussion and make things difficult for people who dissent from it. The problem I've got is that often that means you end up being in the kind of allegiance with really right-wing people or just right-wing people who just fundamentally disagree with the whole left-wing or progressive worldview or the liberal worldview, however you want to just define what the dominant one at the moment is. And that's not necessarily the case in my case, at least. It's not like I strongly disagree with everything that those people are trying to uphold. It's just that what really stands out is the amount of pressure they put on other people to conform to a narrow set of opinions. And so when I kind of think about free speech, I understand that it's in certain circumstances, it's just normative pressures stopping people saying things which shift over time. But it seems like that's kind of gone a bit too far. But I mean, is that your understanding of it or?
Oh yeah, I agree totally. It's we're too punitive in trying to enforce these norms. It's important. You're right that it's the progressives who are doing most of the enforcing of norms. I think though, it's because Western civilization is moving more and more to the left. So they're kind of riding that sentiment. If there's a war tomorrow and we identify a bad guy, progressives who are anti-war are going to be censored. It's just that right now we're in a time period where they're on the right side of history in some ways. But you're absolutely right. It's just we're too punitive. And I think it happens because we're not in that scene. There was this guy who, this professor at UCLA, a Chinese professor, maybe you saw this or not, where there's a Chinese word that sounds like nigger. And so he said it in class.
Oh yeah, I saw this.
I saw this. That's right. Nothing suggests to me that guy was intentionally trying to do that.
Yeah.
But, you know, the student said some things, If this was 1980, the dean would say, look, guys, just get over it, move on. But no, it goes on Twitter. And then people online put pressure on the school. The school has to keep their reputation. So they take that guy out of the class. It's totally uncalled for. But I think it's powered by technology.
Yeah, I was in China and I heard people saying that word all the time. I don't speak Chinese. And I was like, this is unbelievably confusing. Yeah, I mean, that's the most ridiculous, in my opinion, banning that guy. I mean, it's just like, it's got nothing to do with racism. It's just kind of outrage.
That's right. That's right. I mean, it might be that the students are a little bit offended, but that should be settled by just talking and say, okay, you know, I didn't mean to do this. I'm sorry about that. Something and move on. I mean, you know, who would think that Chinese professor is trying to offend those students? You know.
All right. So I wrote down some things which I wanted to debate with you about because I figured we might actually just get along. So, but actually now that we're in the middle of the discussion, I kind of don't feel like we're actually going to end in having that much of a debate. But anyway, so you tweeted something which said, it's not the left that is no longer liberal, it's that you are no longer liberal. You're the equivalent of a former FDR voter who switches to Nixon because of that King character causing racial division and privileged sex-crazed kids saying things like groovy. So
that's a great tweet. I don't remember doing it, but that's
all right. I don't want to like put you on the spot, by the way. So we definitely didn't have, but I'm just saying, like, I just thought I'd get some quotes which are like interesting things that you said. So that was like something which I read and I was like, okay, I understand the point you're making and kind of a percentage of my brain actually agrees with that perspective. Basically, you're saying there's a shift which is happening societally and the people who are complaining about cancel culture and freedom of speech restrictions and stuff are basically just on the wrong side of that. And so they're feeling like their speech is restricted more than it is because they're just on the wrong side of things. And I definitely do understand that perspective because it does seem like there are a lot of people who just, I mean, if you were actually racist, it would seem like your speech was being really unfairly restricted all the time. But actually, I guess it's just a kind of societal understanding that even if it's legal to say a racist thing, it's not socially acceptable. So to some extent, there's like a social sanction on it. But do you not think that isn't necessarily an accurate analogy given the situation at the moment? So let me just get the quote. So it's like, so you say, it's not the left that is no longer liberal, it's you that are no longer liberal. To some extent, do you not think that what people take issue with is the fact that the left has started to do stuff which, in a traditional understanding of what liberal means, i.e. basically letting most people make their points openly and debating them, the left have actually stopped endorsing that way of understanding how to go about things. So to take one example, if you have someone who comes onto a campus and is openly critical of radical Islam, which is, I could be seen as a liberal position because throughout history, I guess liberals have been quite secular in their understanding of society. They are quite likely to face a real pushback from a lot of progressive students, much more so than if they were to say something which is, you know, something which is traditionally seen as quite illiberal about the positives of conservative Islam, let's say. You know, it's like a very complicated thing to see how liberal and illiberal fits into that picture. So do you not think that it's a slight oversimplification to say that the left is the liberal side, that anyone who's left out is actually just kind of moving into the conservative area of things?
Maybe. I think that what it means to be, so I said liberal, I was kind of playing off of the, I don't know, who's that? Dave Rubin, who says the left is no longer liberal. So I was kind of playing off of that. But, right. But I do think that being a progressive, so maybe I should use that, I don't know, means something today. And historically that has meant being voting, at least in the US, for the Democratic Party. And so there are people who maybe 15 years ago felt they were progressive, maybe liberal, and would have voted for that party. But now what it means to be that is not how they feel. And so they want to say things like, well, I vote Democrat, but I don't like what's going on, which to me suggests that probably your place is with the Republican, is the Republican Party. So, I mean, even, and I think that with young people, they don't feel this idea or sense this idea that their speech is limited. For some people, but most, no. In fact, I've made the argument frequently that, look, if I walk into a classroom and I sit down, it could be like one student over here saying, you know what, I'm having top surgery next week, and just talking about it openly, right? And then another student over here is talking about, well, you know, I had sex last night and that was fun. I mean, obviously not everyone, no, but they're talking amongst each other, right? Right. And another person is talking about their drug use. Another person is talking about racist white people, which could be jarring for some, but that's free speech. Those things are on the table. Never in history were we able to talk about those things like that. So we have more. So I think that the things that people want to say are probably generational. And so for people my generation and older, they think, oh, something's wrong. But for kids, they may have more free speech than ever before in human society.
Yeah, but do you not think that, so I definitely understand that point, but do you not think that part of the reason why they feel like their speech isn't restricted is that in general, there's an alignment between a lot of youthful people who are at university, let's say, and a particular form of left liberal politics, which is becoming increasingly dominant in the kind of cultural sphere. And so they are essentially the ones who are enforcing the restrictions on free speech and anyone else. So obviously from their perspective, they can say whatever they want because they're the ones who are in control of what the dominant discourse is. But then if someone was to come into the room and say, yeah, but I actually, you know, I'm pro-life or I support Israel, or, you know, there's a whole range of different policies, or I oppose radicalism, or the different discussions which you're not really meant to have from within that worldview, it would be basically impossible. And 15 years ago, that would have been fine. They could have said that. They could have had a discussion with their university professors. And now they might be like, you know, it's serious. They might face some kind of serious social sanctions, or even worse, depending on what the issue is at universities. And so weirdly, even though I'm not advocating one of those sets of positions being right, I think it's good that the liberal kids are allowed to speak about whatever they want, and I support that totally. It does seem like those are the guys who are restricting everyone else from being able to speak. So that'd be my view on it, I guess.
Yeah, no, actually, I mean, we're having like a kind of debate in a way, but I would like it if everyone could say what they wanted to say.
Yeah.
It's just, I kind of, putting it in context, I realize that it's never perfect. And I'm not a person, like, I think that there is hate speech. I think that words can be used to hurt, you know, so taking all those things into account, I don't have the same negative reaction as others do. If anything, it would be nice if we would be nicer to people. There's no need to fire someone for what they say. It's crazy. But I understand why you might want to say, look, don't say that here. This is offensive, you know, something like that.
Cool. So going forward, what do you see the kind of next 5-10 years panning out like in the US? That's kind of a broad and impossible question to answer, but what's your feeling? Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, right now we're in this racialized space, but that's going to change eventually. There's always these cycles. So, I mean, it was like this in the 60s, I think maybe the early 90s, and then now. So eventually this will go away. And I think that the big issue is going to be economic inequality. And for me, what is going to be most interesting is how this plays out. So we can go back to the critical theory part of it. We're focused on critical race theory a lot.
Yeah.
But the overall idea is to deal with oppression and inequality. So I can certainly see in the next 4 or 5 years, a lot of graduate students saying, okay, I want to apply this idea of critical scholarship to inequality. And it's a very clear, so if I may, the easiest way to think about the idea of critical theory is, one, it's a value-oriented discipline. So you already know what bridge you want to build. So you're not asking if there's a bridge to be built, right? You already know there's inequality, so you don't have to test for that. Instead, what you're trying to do is figure out how to build the bridge. So I'm doing a kind of applied science analogy. So, okay, you know there's inequality, or you assume there is. So what can I do in the real world to deal with that inequality? So it's political. So it's value-oriented and it's political. And the idea is that there are these underlying patterns that maybe the average person doesn't see, but as the scholar, I can see them, and that can help deal with the inequality. So not to bore your viewers too much, but I just needed that background. So yeah. I can imagine that what's going to happen is you're going to take that same approach to economic inequality. You're going to say, all right, you know, you've got people in the United States, especially white folks, increasingly are on the wrong end of things in terms of class. Okay, this is something we have to fix. We don't have to ask why it's happening. We have to deal with, we have to figure out how to fix it. So how are the elites fooling Americans to vote for bad policies? And they're going to come with all kinds of terms to deal with that issue. And it's going to be in the news. So the question that I have is, how will people react to that? So it's one thing if you're a white person and you're accused of being a racist. So of course there's an incentive to say, no, I don't like critical race theory. This is divisive. This is bad for society. But what's going to happen when those same ideas are put to class? That's going to be interesting for me if that happens. You know, how will people deal with that? Will they still wholesale reject critical theory, or will they embrace it more?
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you could give this show a good rating and a review on whatever podcast app you're using, that's great, because it really helps people find it. One final point, all of our interviews, including this one, are available on YouTube. So if you prefer watching things rather than listening to them, you can find every interview there. Just search for E2 Review Podcast, either on Google or on YouTube itself, and our page should come up. I'll also include a link to our page in the show notes. So just click on that and it'll take you there if that's easier. Okay, thanks for listening.